Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome. Okay, everybody, welcome back to this week's episode. I know that many of you are here to listen to One Broken Mom because you identify with the fact that you have a complicated childhood and a family of origin history. And what you're presently addressing in your life might be just your own healing or self-development, or it actually can be in combination with parenting if you have your own children. Now, some of us in life, despite the challenges or adversities we've experienced, are able to maintain some degree of connection with our family, and some of us elect to limit it altogether. Now, unfortunately, there are some of you out there, though, who actually feel trapped by your family in some way. And I've heard from some of the listeners of the show who say that they have parents that maybe have control of their finances, or they're unable to leave because they don't have the money, or they feel trapped by shame and guilt and this feeling of having to be responsible for their parents' needs, or maybe the needs of siblings or somebody else that is less fortunate. So because that's such an important thing of this sense of hopelessness, I reached out to Dr. Elizabeth Cohen to come here onto the show with me and talk to me today. She has a PhD in clinical psychology from Boston University and is considered one of New York City's experts in the field of cognitive behavioral therapy with her private practice. She's the recipient of the prestigious American Psychological Foundation Research Award for her doctoral research. And following her time at Boston University, she completed her pre-doctorate internship at Bellevue Hospital Center and the New York University Child Study Center. After completing her training, she was asked to become the director of the CBT program at the Bellevue Outpatient Psychiatry Clinic. She's been featured in the Wall Street Journal, NBC News, Women's Health, HuffPost, Thrive Global, Good Housekeeping. And she also has her own podcast called Off the Couch. And I found her because she had talked about this topic of cutting ties with toxic family members. And so I felt like she was the person to be able to have this conversation with today. So welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ami. Thank you so much for having me. And your show is such an important resource for people. I think that it is so essential for people to not feel alone in talking about trauma, talking about struggles, talking about separating from family members. You are just busting shame in a way that is so helpful for us as therapists and so inspiring as a person.
Well, thank you very much. I really do appreciate this. You know, my mantra kind of going into this is just help one person. I'm helping myself. I'm helping my kids. And it didn't seem fair to keep the information to myself. So sharing it. And so I appreciate, you know, the time that you're taking to be able to do this. And so, so thank you. I want to start by talking about this, the word trapped, because, you know, sometimes people feel that they're in a genuinely captive situation that, you know, but most often we're not actually shackled or literally locked in a room with somebody. So the concept of trapped is, in a sense, a belief or psychological condition to begin with that people try to find ways to, you know, to confirm. So can you talk about where this feeling of being trapped might actually originate for people?
Absolutely. So first, I just want to say in talking about this topic, I think we need to start by acknowledging that we are the minority who are willing to talk about this, who are willing to think about taking a break or cutting off from family as a possibility. So our culture gives us the message that family first, mm-hmm. and no matter how family treats you, you have to accept them. So we are really going against a huge current. I always talk about it like when you try to explain to your kids not to eat sugary foods, even though they have 10,000 messages within 2 hours on YouTube of sugary food. So we're just getting messages all the time to not do this. So the first feeling I think of being trapped is really kind of a societal trapped of not having a language and a space to talk about this. So that's kind of the first piece that I just want to say before we start.
And yeah,
that,
I totally agree.
Yeah. And it's like war, like you guys are warriors. Like we are the ones of us who want to consider that, even consider this, not even do it, are warriors because we're pushing against the grain that everyone is saying not to do this or it's disrespectful or shameful. So I love the question about trapped, and I'm so glad that you use that word in your reader. The person who wrote into that is so right to use that word. So as you know, and fear comes from our natural biological adaptive response of fight or flight. And one of the situations with which we have a physiological response is being trapped. That we actually, there are a number of situations that our amygdala or our base of our emotional brain kind of have listed as things to quick put on the fight or flight response. A fire, an earthquake.
An earthquake.
Right? Yeah. You hear these stories about moms, dads who can like pick up their car because when the kid has gotten hurt under it, right? So these situations that are listed that we have to, that our physiological body for survival has to get out of. And being trapped is one of them. So when we feel trapped, either, as you're saying, physically, financially, metaphorically, emotionally, we are going to have a fight or flight response that we need to activate. And when we don't essentially flee or fight to get out of the trapped feeling, we still have the physiological response of the fight or flight experience, but we have it all the time with no place to put it. So it can look like rumination, it can look like panic attacks, it can look like depression, because essentially we're not allowing ourselves, consciously or unconsciously, to really break free of something. So the fact that the person who wrote in even notices that they're trapped is fantastic, because a lot of the people I work with will come in and say, oh, I'm having a problem in my relationship, having no idea that it's related to this feeling of being trapped in your family of origin. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty astounding too, because you know, we also talk a lot about on the show about abusive relationships and the fact that, you know, no one feels trapped in that relationship until the end. They kind of are just walking along the path of dealing with a complicated situation or a tough personality or whatever they want to do. And then until it kind of finally the ball of stress in them has built up of trying to accommodate for that so much that suddenly it is like, I'm trapped, I'm stuck. I can't, you know, I can't get out of this.
I think another piece is that we blame ourselves. So if we find ourselves in a trapped situation, we have two choices. We can either think, oh my gosh, my captors are terrible and I need to fight and get out of this. Or if that doesn't work, because one, if we're a kid, when we're children, we can't really think that about our parents, because if we did, we wouldn't be provided and we wouldn't be able to survive. It's a threat to our system. Or if we're in a situation where we feel that we can't, we have no agency, like you said, in an abusive relationship, then we start doing what we do in those situations, which we blame ourselves. So we blame ourselves for being trapped. Mm-hmm. Why can't, this is something I hear a lot. And I know actually in my own experience, I've thought this, like, if I just figured out a strategy for how to deal with my mom, then it would be fine. Or
I heard that there was a dog.
They do bark.
Yeah.
That, you know, how do you, you know, if I could just figure out a way for me, I always say to my clients, like, to twist myself into a pretzel to be okay with her. Why can't I have that? It's like, you can't twist yourself in a pretzel to get out of being trapped. Like that isn't, you can do a million gymnastics in that box, but that's still not going to get you out.
Right, right, exactly. Now, what kinds of family members are the ones that we should start considering cutting off? You know, I've talked with other folks on here about how to make certain relationships work, and not necessarily how to fix them, but as mostly how to modulate ourselves in that relationship and what we need to do to kind of manage ourselves in it. But there are people that we do need to really strongly consider, like, exiting out, either emotionally cutting them off or physically, you know, no contact with them. And so how would you characterize those types of family members?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's two parts to this. There are some real specifics that you can just kind of make a list of. So someone who's actively using alcohol or drugs, you know, you can love them, you can send them love, but as far as interacting with them on a daily basis, needing them for support and help, they're really not available because they are preoccupied with whatever their disease is at the time, sadly. I think anyone who would be physically abusive to you, you know, so kind of overtly violent, neglectful people, that would kind of be the first. But I think what's more difficult and what's more interesting to us sometimes is like the softer symptoms or the softer signs. I would say that it's also very personal. So something that I could tolerate, you might not be able to tolerate because of your living history, because of who you are in the world, because of your privileged status. And I really like to respect your experience, that if your experience with this person is that you leave feeling worse than when you came in, that's important to me. That is really important to me. I don't want you to push those feelings away. I talk with clients about having an emotional hangover after seeing parents. I have had a client who I've been working with for years who had a very, abusive, not physically abusive, but controlling father. And if he knew his father was even in New York City, not even seeing him because he had decided not to see him, his whole nervous system would get activated and he would not be able to write. He's a writer. He would drink more. I mean, and we talked about, you know, even if he's not in front of you, this is what energetically is happening for you. Mm-hmm. So that's someone who, again, like on the surface, and even more so, which is, you know, one of the things that happens a lot of the kind of parent that a lot of people have to distance from are narcissistic parents. Mm-hmm. And what's so challenging about that for the child is that to the outside world, they seem so wonderful. Mm-hmm. And they seem so approachable. And that's the situation with this client. So it was so challenging because you not only is it hard to stick with what you feel like is right for you, but then you have all these other people saying things like, I wish he was my father, that kind of.
Yeah. And I've seen people experience that, where that outside perception of that. And then that just adds more to that that guilt and that shame that maybe your decision and also those senses of doubt, like maybe I'm not evaluating this. I mean, you know, for people that have grown up in some type of an environment like that, we're used to also questioning our reality, you know, and you're just like, okay.
That's a coping strategy. So mm-hmm. For a kid to question their reality and think better about your parent is a good thing to do when you are a kid who's dependent on them. But when you're an adult, that's when we start with the trauma work to kind of separate that out. But when you hear other people feeding you that, you can kind of flip back into that child's mentality. Mm-hmm.
For sure. Now, I know my choice here on this one, on this particular question was I definitely got tired of feeling like every time there was an interaction that it was just left in frustration. Like, okay, I don't even think this person even understands me. I just didn't feel connected. And this is with my mother and growing up. And so when I was like 18 and able to move on and go to college, like I moved and then, I picked a job, you know, I'm from the Midwest and I picked a job in the furthest corner of the United States and just packed up and, you know, family was a little shocked that I just packed up and moved. They really had no sense of the fact of just how frustrated and even angry I had gotten towards the end of just feeling this kind of lack of connection and just constantly being disappointed, you know, wanting and hoping for something that was never going to happen. And so looking out, you know, for people that are looking outward at the family, and I know that this is happening a lot now since I've started to become more of an advocate, is like, wow, I never really knew that that was happening or that you felt that way. Because on the surface, like you mentioned with the narcissistic family, it probably looked fine. It looked no worse than anybody else's situation, but my choice was I just didn't like the way I felt after all of the interactions and even the phone calls. And I just started to just make that the emotional connection to me was already gone, but it turned into the physical connection. Don't go visit, no phone calls, nothing like that. And just let it, you know, just kind of let it happen.
Wow. Well, first I just want to say, I mean, you are so brave. I mean, I am so impressed that at that age you were able to see that you weren't getting what you needed. Like, that is just so impressive. Like, well done. And just amazing strength. like fantastic. And of course, and I think that you're bringing up such a beautiful point that I hadn't thought about until this moment when you said it, which is that, you know, we're talking about cutoffs as if this is some big new experience or surprise. But for those of us who have felt neglected, who have felt like the person wasn't there, in some ways, we're just being consistent with what our experience is, right?
Right.
And that had a cutoff in my life too. And that is what it felt like. It actually felt like I decided to do the cutoff because it felt more authentic and genuine to be in the cutoff, the lack of contact, than to pretend that we were in contact when there was really nothing there.
Right, right, exactly. You know, and I've said this too before about that in terms of the lack of contact between my mother and self, it was a mutuality. You know, she also never really felt the need. And so you were absolutely right. Like you just had phrased what it felt like. It said, I felt like I was the one doing work and effort and trying to create something that wasn't going to ever happen. And then finally, you know, after having two kids and just seeing like, this just isn't going to be that. It felt like I'm just going to let it go. I'm just going to make it like, let it take its natural course. And its natural course was, I did the math probably about a year ago a year and a half ago when I started, you know, this whole journey here. And I calculated that now I have now lived half of my life with no contact with my mother, that the sum of the experiences since I moved out is fewer and fewer far between that. And that is, again, both of us just kind of like, you know, casting it to the, you know, to the wind and letting it play out instead of putting in the energy of trying to make it work. How many times do you think that other people are doing that, a natural cutoff, but instead are overworking to maintain contact with a toxic family member?
Yeah, I think that that is what happens most of the time. I mean, I think if you gave anyone kind of two options, they would take the one of overworking. Again, going back to this kind of cultural push that you're supposed to do this for your family, that you're supposed to work hard, that even that family is supposed to be toxic. I mean, around the holidays, you know, people talk about, oh, the holiday, you know, like how is that what we have in our culture? Why do we accept that? That we all hate, you know, that there are all these articles about how to handle your toxic families at the holidays. Like, how is that a thing that is what we just support? I think we were going to get to this about how some of the reactions the parents might have, but you're bringing it up now, which is so beautiful. And you're so right on about this. And this can be hard for people to hear. But when people are usually afraid about how their parent is going to react. And if you are separating from a parent because of neglect or often narcissism, it's the sad truth, which you know somewhere inside, is they don't really follow. They don't pursue you. They don't come after you. That hope sometimes, or worry, that they're going to get so mad, they're going to be so upset. I had this fantasy that my parent would show up at the door, you know, was a childhood fantasy that they would show up, but really knowing who they are, of course they didn't.
Right. Right. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. That's a good point there too. So one of the things that we run into is, and I'm guilty of doing this myself, you know, and I sit there and I evaluate, I'm single now, thankfully, gratefully so at this point, after a number of bad choices. Again, healing heals everything. But you know, I sit there and I wonder, like, okay, can I look at somebody and look at their family relationship and use that as a judgment? And then I sit there and think to myself, if I looked at somebody and said, you're in contact with your family, that's a good thing. That's not always the case, because I'm not in much contact with my family. And to me, that's a good thing. And that's a healthy thing. But let's say we end up meeting somebody and we have good boundaries, whatever they may be, with our family members. We're happy with them. We're healthy with them. But this other person seems to have some of that toxic bleeding going on. And we think that they should separate, you know, emotionally cut off or physically cut off from their family members. Is that something that we should approach with a partner and champion with them or for them?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I love questions about relationships. It's something that I specialize in as well. I'm actually working now on I have an online program for people post separation and divorce to see that they have like a wonderful, you can have a wonderful life after that. And one of the things we talk so much about that is how to communicate with your ex or your current new partner, when you want them something to change about them. And so, of course, if you have had the experience of needing to cut off your family, feeling like it was healthy for you, feeling abundant, feeling like part of why this person's in your life is because of that, it can be very triggering and very intense when you either see the same pattern or a similar pattern. And you can get into that protective mode. Just like anyone who's, you know, read a great book about trauma or had, you were saying, a business coach, you know, you want to, we want to just, people we love, we want to share our wisdom. And so what I suggest to people is really to share your experience, strength, and hope. To share your experience of how this happened for you. So your partner comes to you and says, oh my God, you know, I felt so crappy after I talked to my parent. They were so dismissive and say, oh yeah, I remember when that happened with me. I used to try to make it better and find stories she would like and entertain her. And then I realized I just felt bad. So I would just really use your experience rather than going into, hey, I think you should do this. Because the reaction is always going to be defensiveness or you're attacking my parent or protection. You know, I have a 14-year-old son who just has his first girlfriend, and he was saying that he was angry at his girlfriend's mom. And I said, let me tell you something. You can tell me as much as you want about that, but be careful telling her, because we all have a needed, you know, to protect our parents, even if we're mad at them. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Now, what should we do if we, if we're in the situation and our, this partner actually doesn't want to separate, from him? Because like you mentioned, it can be very triggering to be around that. And, you know, that can end up being something where you're going to want to have that cut off, and you have to figure out how to negotiate, you know, what that looks like for you to be able to either deal with it, which, you know, it's tough to do that, or say, listen, these are my boundaries. I can't be involved in this. And so, I mean, how would you counsel somebody through that?
Yeah. I was just rereading the article in Fatherly, and that was one of the examples, was a couple where that happened. And it's challenging. I think that the most important thing is to be clear about your boundaries, set your boundaries. I have a client that I work with now who just said, you know, I am not going to see your parents. You can take our daughter if you feel comfortable seeing your parents. But I, because it wasn't an unsafe situation, it just was very uncomfortable for her. And he had a choice of either to accept that or to fight her on it. And sometimes those ruptures, those struggles are actually really beautiful growth for a relationship. Mm-hmm. I just think we can't avoid... We can't hold our needs and boundaries back just to make our partner happy.
Okay, so if you are in a relationship and you actually have a family and you have children that are involved in this, and you and your partner do decide that some degree of separation, or maybe it's just, you know, you as a single parent deciding that you need to not, you know, deal with your parents anymore. You know, what are some ways of communicating this to your own children so that they understand, you know, why we're not going to grandma and grandpa's anymore or calling them or seeing them? Because there is, you know, kids are connected to their grandparents or their aunts and uncles in different ways.
Yeah. So I think there's two important pieces to consider. The first is that we have to remember that those little eyes are always watching us, and we are teaching them and modeling all the time. So you also have to remember that if you take shit from a parent, for example, or if you act nice when you're around them because you repress all your feelings and then you come home and, you know, say nasty things about them, your kids are learning that behavior. So if you become clear on what you need and you have clear boundaries, you're teaching your kids to have clear boundaries. So that's one of the things that really gets my clients to make the change sometimes. Which is, how would you feel? It gives me chills, actually. I love my body. I'm very connected to my body, but it gives me chills of, like, this work you mentioned earlier about epigenetics. Like, this is important work for the future generations, and I believe even to heal the past. So what are we showing our kids? And so is being nice or have it making sure that there's no rupture and that it looks like we have a, you know, grandparents come to grandparents' day. Is that really what the value is for you? Or is it modeling being authentic and honest about your needs? Because that's what they're going to learn.
Yeah, actually. Yeah. That's a great, that's a That's a fantastic point. The modeling of that, because when you definitely, when you show up, you know, it's twofold. When you show up and they see you capitulating, or, you know, and sometimes depending on the dynamic of your family, you might be being teased. You might have a parent that talks down to you all the time and you just kind of tolerating that. That is definitely what those kids are seeing. And I could see where some of your clients would go, oh, I hadn't thought of it in that perspective, because we're self-centered, right? We think about it from our perspective. But that primal instinct of parenting of like, is that really what you want to be teaching your kids about that? That's huge.
Yeah. I often say, like, would you want them to tolerate that from a partner?
Yeah. It's like a no-brainer. Of course not.
Exactly. They're like, no, don't. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other piece that I wanted to share is that, you know, research shows that, you know, kids need love. They need, and lots of love is great, but really they need one super supportive person in their life. And that can be a teacher. That can be an aunt, auntie, who is, we said, chosen family, right? It doesn't have to be a family member. So this drama about they won't have a grandparent is just, it's made up, kind of. It's a fairy tale, right? I mean, it's kind of the same thing. I just thought of this, of like the evil stepmother. I feel so terrible for stepmothers. Like, they're not evil. Like, I don't know how that, you know, or the grandmother being the loving one. That's not always the case. Mm-hmm. So really to kind of let go of the feeling that they have to have a grandparent, or you had this image of an uncle. And again, in that situation with your kids, as I'm saying this, you know, that's probably your little kid self wanting that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Wanting either the relationship with the parent to begin with, or the fantasy of the relationship that they were going to somehow have this beautiful bond that you were imagining when you were pregnant, you know? Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
In my situation, I actually had the cutoff, but my children did not. And that was because the person in my life was less toxic with my children. Just happened to be, for whatever, you know, that's the gray. Mm-hmm. And so that's how it worked with us, but it doesn't always work that way. But that took a lot of flexibility and identifying my feelings to be able to manage that, of course.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, that's absolutely right. Now we've been talking about parents as being the toxic family members that we need to cut off, but sometimes they are siblings as well. Right. Yeah. And is there anything that we kind of approach that differently if it's a sibling that we have to just kind of say, I'm done with?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So what I would say is, rather than focusing on the family members, the issue is when you are put in a position that is not the appropriate position for you to be put in your family. So if it's with your parent and they're treating you like a child, for example, or they're not parenting you, or they're not seeing you, that is one situation. With a sibling, it could be if a sibling is requesting for you to be a parent, mm-hmm. which happens a lot if you had a neglectful parent. So if you had a neglectful parent, it's very likely that you're going to have siblings trying to get you to be the parent. So right. I think really thinking about, is it in this relationship with my family member, is the boundary appropriate, and is the request, and is the, you know, the need relationship appropriate? Mm-hmm. Is this person needing me to be their sister, their child, or are they asking me to be something else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now I can imagine in families, and in fact, it's, you know, like I said, it's going to be in my family where, because everybody's experienced each other in totally different ways, which is true of everything, right? We don't truly know everyone. And so when we make judgments on someone else's experience based on only our own observations, that's a dangerous place to be in. But yet we are all constantly judged by other people and what they think happened to us and what they saw and thought they happened. So when you start to go down this path of cutting off a family member, you know, it feels like at times it can grow into the family and, you know, overall, depending on what maybe the emotional posturing is of everybody in the family, right? Which feels like it would be a completely, I mean, I can speak from experience, it feels unsettling to know that while I'm making certain choices about certain certain things in my life, somehow everybody else just kind of got lopped into it, either on this camp or this camp, because of not understanding and not having a full vision of what's going on, or not even being able to comprehend that choice. Because like you said, culturally, we're not supposed to cut off family. You know, we're supposed to, blood is blood, right? Which I've told people is bullshit. You know, blood is not blood. Our blood runs through our body in 16 days. Guess what? It's gone. You know? Yeah.
Right. A lot of us have friends that are family. We have chosen family, right? We have, it's a completely different thing. You know, I think it's such an important point that you're bringing up. And one of the things that I encourage people to do if they feel comfortable is to think about a way to communicate with the other people in the system about what you're doing. We can't control other people's reactions. Not only are they not maybe going to see it because they had a different experience, but even more so, they might have had the same experience as you, but not be ready to admit it. So there's going to be even more rage and defensiveness because they're actually more identified with you, but not ready to see that. Mm-hmm. So I often recommend to people in this circumstance to have a 4 or 5, you know, sentence thing to say, or an email just saying, I just want to let you know, as a member of my family or someone I really care about, I'm going to not be speaking with my brother for a while. And I know that you might have some feelings about it. And if you feel comfortable saying, I'm happy to talk about those feelings, you can say that. If not, you can say, I don't feel ready to talk about it. I really would appreciate your support during this time.
Yeah, that's a good strategy there. Wow. Now, when we cut somebody off, is it possible to repair that relationship and bring that relationship back in?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what's so interesting is, before we cut off, we usually think the other person will have to change in order for something to change. But truly, I don't know if this has been your experience, with the cutoff, my experience with my cutoff was that the first weekend after the cutoff, I was able to do personal work that I had never been able to do. So I just started to thrive. So then when I was after the cutoff, I was different. Because I had done all this work because of the cutoff. I don't know if that makes sense.
It makes complete sense.
Yeah, right. So she didn't change at all. But, but what happened for me because of the cutoff and because of the space, I changed. And then I could come back in a way that felt right.
Right. And I think that's important too, because, you know, people may think that this is an absolute, right? That once you cut it off, it's done. And, you know, it could be, I guess that's a fair statement, because the other family member might actually be truly offended and they'll never want to talk to you again. And we see that sadly in families. But it might be, like you said, because the other family member rarely does change. I mean, that's kind of like this overarching scope of really healing is not about fixing everybody around us and then our life is better. Ultimately, it lands on our shoulders. I mean, we are accountable for our experiences. And as adults, you know, we were gifted them, you know, as children. But now what we do in moving forward is, you know, is on our shoulders. And that maybe the cutoff is just to give you the air that you need to be able to work on yourself. And maybe there is away. And I will say that, you know, it was one of those things with my own was especially doing some really hardcore work, not only just with the show and being able to talk to amazing people like you and learn every time I do an interview, but also with my own therapy. I was getting myself to a place where I wanted to be able to come back in and be able to speak with my mother. Now, as people that listen to One Broken Mom will know, at the beginning of season 2, my mother ended up being diagnosed with dementia in the between seasons. And now there is no capacity for a conversation. Like the moment is past, it's gone. It is what it is. But I had changed and have changed enough in there to be able to alter and, you know, and figure out, like, how do I adapt now to this situation? I ask that because I think some people are afraid of cutting off to begin with, thinking that it's going to be a final answer. And it doesn't have to be. It can be just a pause, a 20-year pause, a 5-week pause, a whatever, right?
Yeah, we live in this, I think it comes back to, you know, our survival instincts, where we do with friends, with relationships, with family, we think that it's everything so absolute, wherein really it is so fluid. Mm-hmm. And, right. You know, when we talk about, especially one of the big areas where people have to cut off is with substance abuse, and actually cutting off is an intervention for some people. And and if you spend any time in rooms or of AA rooms or with recovery, you know, you hear about fluidity, that things come and things go and relationships come and may go. I think we need to spend more time really understanding that things are, relationships are not absolute. Mm-hmm. Just like, I always use the example of the sun. I'm in New York, so it might be different where you are, but where your listeners are. But you know, if it's a cloudy day, the sun is still there. It's mm-hmm. just behind the clouds. So things come and things go. Mm-hmm.
That's a great metaphor. And in the Seattle area, that's how we survive, knowing that somewhere out there, the sun is still shining, even if it's behind all the clouds. You know, like I said, one of the listeners has talked about financial abuse. I know that that has actually been a real issue for me as well in a relationship, where part of my feelings of being trapped were because my financial situation was tied in with a business that we shared. And one of those, like, can I make this happen? Can I actually leave? Well, gosh, if I did, then I lose this. Or in the case of some people where their finances are actually being controlled by a family member, you know, do you have any particular advice to handle that a little bit differently? Because sometimes people don't view financial abuse as actually, you know, abuse. And it feels like it's, again, another real trap, because you go, well, my bank account is over there, therefore I can't buy things. But again, I wonder out loud if it's just, again, a belief that you're really trapped and there aren't actually things that you can do to remove the perception that you're also being financially trapped.
Yeah. I mean, I think that probably financially trapped is the one that's the less likely to be a belief, because it's actually based on, you know, mm-hmm. hard money.
Yeah.
And so what I think about being, what we do as what I do as a cognitive behavioral therapist, about breaking things down into small pieces, and kind of similarly how we just talked about absolutes, that it's true. Like, you cannot, if you are financially dependent on someone, you cannot up and leave and support yourself the next day. Like, that's absolutely true. And in the work I do with lots of people through divorce, that's a big reason why a lot of people don't get divorced. Mm-hmm. Like, just kind of like that. Mm-hmm. And so, and if you were to look at the numbers and look at, and that's what they do, they tend to take broad strokes. So I would say, if you feel financially trapped, to start with small ways to not feel trapped, even if it's not financial, emotionally. I mean, it can be financial in the sense that you can, and I don't mean to, you know, sometimes cognitive behavioral therapy can seem so obvious and seem like I'm dumbing it down, but I don't mean to be simple about it, but you could, you know, collect the change that you see in your house, you know, do small behaviors to show that you have some control. Or we live in New York, like, don't order in for a week and put that money aside, right? Or take some time to take pleasure and enjoy yourself and feel some control over your own body, let's say. So mm-hmm. I really believe that feeling how to get not trapped is very small, tiny steps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember the person that wrote me, I had said something to her similarly, because she was concerned about the bank account being watched. And it's like, well, if you normally take out $5 every once in a while for coffee, go open a checking account, you know, take that out. You don't have to tell anybody, you know, not that, you know, lying is a good thing, but if you're trying to do something like this and you've got somebody legitimately questioning every, you know, every action that you take, start by just opening up your own checking account and put in, it doesn't have to be hundreds of dollars every time, but starting at $5 a time. And next thing you know, there you go. With the idea, like you were saying, that it trains you of giving you some degree of power, right? Like, a small gesture like that is getting some of those different pathways moving and working and reinforcing that you can actually do things, you know, above and beyond feeling.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Beautifully said. That's exactly right. It's like, and then you think, oh, actually I can find it here. It's kind of like why I always suggest people do gratitude lists. It's not because of the list, but because once you're trying to find things to be grateful for, you look for things to be grateful for. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for ways that you can save a little bit of money, you're going to start taking in, oh, I have a little bit more financial power than I think.
Yeah. Right. Cool.
I would say also, get help with that. Like, there, if you really feel trapped and there is no way, you know, to get help from local services that can really help you. And there are a lot of charities that will help you get on your feet.
That's a good point. Definitely a good point. So do you have any specific tools or strategies you'd recommend for somebody, like the first steps, if they are looking at needing to start to build some separation from themselves, and maybe it's their parents, or maybe it's a family member that, again, and we're talking about, you know, the ones that feel that there's a sense of containment around you that you like, oh, you know, I need to let them go, but I don't know how. And oftentimes that is, like we said, our parents could be those people there that we have to do that with. So how does somebody take like that first step?
Well, I think the first step is put a hand on your heart and give yourself a ton of compassion for how hard this is. So before we get into any sort of action, we just have to ground ourselves in our bodies, in our needs, and be on our own side with this.
That's good. And getting that confidence and peace. It's good.
And also, have help. And it's a therapist. I mean, us therapists, we are all about cut-up. We're not afraid to talk about cut-ups. It might not be a friend. Maybe it is a friend. Maybe it's a support group. But don't go it alone, because you're going to feel so much more alone anyway, because you're leaving a very familiar, as you said, neural pathway relationship. So we need to kind of bulk up the outside.
That's a good point too. Now, you touched on it earlier, because you know, I kind of walked you through. We cheated a little bit. She knows some of the questions, but I wanted to talk about, because this is the other part of this is not failing to move forward because of the fear of the reaction. And you know, like you'd said, talking about sometimes there is no reaction. We fear something that really never comes along here. But what should someone expect reactions to be, and to kind of know that that's normal, and that doesn't mean you're doing something wrong, you know, when you see those reactions.
Yeah. So this is kind of a backwards way of answering this. So let me know after I answer this, if you want me to go back and do it again. Remember, it's very important to remember that whatever reaction you get from that person we're recording this in 2019, in 2019, you are getting in an adult nervous system. You are hearing it as an adult who has the capacity to understand complex feelings and experiences. Our trauma experience will most likely make us feel like we're our child nervous system hearing it. So it will feel more threatening. It will feel more intense. It might feel more sadistic. It might feel more painful. So it's really important to understand and say to yourself, which is what I said to myself throughout the whole experience that I went through, was my life isn't in danger. I'm okay. No matter however this person reacts, I am okay. And I truly cannot rescue them. You know, I have clients whose parents have been, or siblings have been threatening to kill themselves for years. And that is an incredible entrapment, because if you leave, I will kill myself. And who would ever in their right mind leave someone who's saying that? But staying hasn't made them stop saying it. And really none of us can make somebody kill themselves. It's really important for people to know that. So letting go of that and saying to yourself, I am not in charge here. Like I am safe. If they choose to take their life, that's their choice, but my life is not in danger.
Yeah, that's actually, I'm glad you said that. And you've said it in a way that I haven't heard that. We talk about that, right? This distinction between the, you know, the trauma history and the trauma story is that we have this, like you said, this nervous system that is really our little person inside surviving. And this little person's survival skills are kind of out of alignment with adult life, you know, in the real, what we're dealing with now. They're not wrong. They were perfectly acceptable when we were children. They were what we needed to have as children, but they don't serve us, you know, any longer as adults. And so the way that you said that there, you know, at the end, I love it, you know, of being mindful of the fact that that fear is that initial rush, that instant. Like, you know, and I've described this on the show, like, I know it's my kid in me because my chest gets really tight fast, like, bam. And that's when I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Okay. Little of me just showed up and she is fucking freaked out, you know, or angry, or, you know, whatever it is. And through therapy, it has been adult in me going, there, you know, you're okay. Like, you're fine, because you do, and you have to talk yourself down, you know, off of that cliff, because we truly do believe, it's been ingrained in us that, you know, it's a dangerous situation. You know, that we have to figure out our way of, dealing with it. And unfortunately we end up tolerating more than what we should, you know, in our life and stuff like that, especially with it, with our family members and stuff. You know, I mentioned this book a million times. I've gushed over this woman. I wish I would have had a chance to meet her, but Alice Miller's The Body Never Lies. And I love her book so much because she just lays it all out there and bears no bones. You know, screw this idea that we're supposed to take everything our parents give us and love them unconditionally with no criticisms of their behavior. And she lays out in this book so many examples of people over the course of history that had terrible toxic relationships with parents, and they suffered physically from it, they emotionally, as well as their own physical well-being and health issues and stuff. And that she just, I mean, she laid it out there like, we have to lose this idea that, you know, the blood is not enough. The parent-child relationship, it does not mean that you have to keep sacrificing your well-being because of that and to lose that. But yet that thou shalt, you know, honor thy mother and father in the Ten Commandments is a very, very deep and rich part of our culture and society. So, I recommend that book for anybody to read, because like, if you have any doubts, just read that and you're like, oh no, Alice Miller's now my fan, you know, my favorite. So, and like I said, I regrettably she's passed away, but it's like, I had mentioned this on another interview. So when people hear this interview, they'll hear me talk about this. But if it was Thomas Jefferson and Alice Miller are my two people that if I could talk to somebody that's passed away and sit on a bench with them, definitely. So,
yeah. Well, you know, when you mentioned, I love that. It's so touching to me about saying like, they're a little girl. And one of that made me think about, another suggestion, which is when you decide to tell your whoever parent, your family member, that you're going to take some time to yourself and not be in touch, or however you decide to do it, I would recommend taking your little girl or little boy and kind of tucking them into a really beautiful place in your where you are not. Or if they need to be there with you, then you can hold them. But really, I like to leave them at home. Like, this is a grown up thing. Like, mm-hmm. You don't have to come here. Like, mommy's got this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and it's one of the things that I think that's a huge advantage. I'll say this, you know, I came into this healing process recognizing my own trauma, but at the same time, my compulsion and kind of being so strongly motivated was because I was, you know, I am also a mother with two children, and seeing them right now, knowing that it was my responsibility to get this under control, get me under control to cure, heal, and do this, because I just couldn't look at them with any degree of, you know, worth and go, I can't let you down. Like, I can't do this. And this is in my hands to do this. And I have found that really it's easy when I sit in, you know, in therapy with my therapist, she gets to sit there and go, what would you say to your son or daughter right now? And then you're going, well, of course I would say that. And it's like being reminded that that's how you have to start talking to yourself. And so I think it is an advantage, ironically, to come from trauma, to have difficulties with parenting, but being a parent actually, you know, really does aid in healing your own self, because you are very aware of what you would and wouldn't say and how you would, you know, nurture and counsel your own kids through their own troubles. And if they were dealing with this and you were watching this as a witness to them going through this, what you would do to put your arms around their, you know, their scared selves and their anxious selves. And so for people that don't have kids, you know, it may be hard to imagine that, but that's almost kind of the switch that you do have to put on, is this, I'm going to parent, I'm going to be my own mom, you know, for the moment and stuff. So,
yeah. Well, one thing I sometimes, if you don't have a child, I think I ask people about, you know, how they would treat their fur babies, or how they would treat mm-hmm. a niece or a nephew, or if they were babysitting, you know, and very quickly we can find that empathy. And I just want to say that, you know, I think it's amazing that you had that awareness. You also, we need to commend you for having that awareness, because not everybody has that awareness. And I think that adage, which I completely disagree with, that wait till you're a parent and you'll see, you know, you'll see how much I did for you. My experience is often for people that when you become a parent, you realize how little you got, especially if you were in a neglectful experience.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Now, I fully admit that that awareness didn't come easy, as it is. And it was, the key for me to get it was to decide to search for it, and to recognize, I had to see myself self-sabotaging. And I say this, I am a curious person, that's always the way that I've been. And so the curiosity of deciding to turn it towards myself to understand my situation, it came like after, I almost would say I felt like I was beating my head against the same wall. I might have been reading different self-help books or whatever, but I wasn't getting it. But it, Wendy Bihari is another guest that I have on the show, and adore her as well. But I was reading her book, Disarming the Narcissist, and there just was a phrase, and it was the most surreal moment to just read two words, childlike and powerless, and then it was just a switch. It was just the dip switch went off in my head. Instantly became emotional because as I described before, a memory of my mom walking out when I was 6 years old just crept right to the front of the brain. And it was the body going, you're going to start right here at this moment here. And then after that, my world was literally changed after that. But, it was constantly pursuing. And it finally, the right thing penetrated that, that wall, that block in there. I know that's not great an encouragement for most people because everybody just wants to know how they can just change when they're ready for it. And it's like, I don't know how to tell you how you have that flashbulb moment in your head. It's like, it's going to have to come, but it definitely doesn't happen if you're just sitting there waiting for it. You kind of almost have to be ready for it,
And I also think that it actually is so antithetical to what we think, and especially in our culture about speed and fast and finding the book that has the title that, we need, mm-hmm. have a good relationship with your parent or something. It actually takes a lot of slowness. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of noticing your fuck ups, mm-hmm. owning them, starting to notice patterns in them. I mean, for me, being on my hands and knees, I tell a story that I knew that I needed to get divorced when I was on my hands and knees, like begging my ex to stop drinking. I realized that I had, lost my own space. And I had a choice when we got divorced to either tell all the bad stories about him, blame him, and there were plenty, mm-hmm. or figure out how did I get myself into this situation. And that's a process that I chose to take. And it was harder than the blaming, to be perfectly honest. Like,
oh, yeah.
People are like all into blaming.
Yep.
So I'm with people. I want people to know that it's slow, that hearing our stories can feel like, oh my God, but it was painful, and there's still painful moments. But you and your listener and you and all of us, like, we're worth it. Mm-hmm. We're worth that hard work. We so are.
We absolutely. And I think that for people looking outside at One Broken Mom, like the overall show, it's not every episode isn't about the same topic. It is knowing that for me, it was taking, the middle, this is me in the center here, and needing to just kind of revolve around it and look at it from so many different angles before the one thing clicks. And my mindset is I just want to keep taking this concept of, of discovering who we really are by getting passed through our trauma histories and our adversities and finding that. But it might not be this episode. It might be this episode or this episode, or it might take 10 of them before you kind of go, okay, I can start to see that. And so that's why I consciously kind of weave around, this is the sun in the middle of it, but each of the stories might be a little bit different with a little slightly different angle for that reason only, hoping that, and it happens. One episode will be the one for somebody that writes me and says, that was it. It's like, hallelujah. Good for you.
What a gorgeous metaphor. I have a teacher who always, I love this phrase. I think about it a lot, that she'll teach and she'll say, I'm just talking to the back of your brain. Like, things will land. You won't even know they'll land, and they'll somehow sprout at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's awesome. The idea of cutting people off is not just the severing of the relationship with somebody that they feel compelled to maintain, but then there's also that sense of, what a strange feeling it is to imagine a life without family. right? And so, you know, how does somebody kind of get over that fear? Because they're, you know, having bad family is not a better option, you know, to being, you know, on your own or, you know, being without family. Now, do you have a way that somebody can kind of get through those feelings, or what are some strategies for them to be able to handle the fact that they are going to be losing people in their life? Yeah. You know, how do we balance those scales?
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you mentioned that, because I think it's very important to have a balance of processing and working through the loss, because it is a loss, as opposed to just, you know, when we say this phrase cut off, it just sounds kind of like there's this phrase like cut with a knife, like cut it, put it away. The truth is we need to separate from it, process the loss, and build in more of what we had always wanted, like our family of choice. So I don't want, I think one of the issues that would make somebody not want to cut off is feeling like they're losing too much and gaining nothing. And I wonder if, you know, part of when cutoffs I've seen in my practice have happened when my clients start seeing there's another opportunity, there's another possibility. Either the kind of parent you are is a different possibility, or you meet an incredibly kind, thoughtful person around your mother's age, and you think, I wish I had had that. Oh, I could have had that. Oh, this person exists. Maybe I can have that. So I just want people to know that it's not just an ending. It's also a beginning and a growing and a filling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you actually, you bring up a possibility for somebody to think about too, which is, you know, beginning to make some independent moves by growing themselves in one way. And we talked about that earlier, about just take small actions and begin to practice doing a few small things. You know, it's kind of like go ahead and find another community, practice building something new with another person, other people. And like you said, it sounds like that might actually then start to give you a little bit more of that confidence on taking a deep breath, because that's what it feels like. You know, to take that deep breath to go, I think then I can do this. Like, I think I'm ready to, you know, to be able to say no to this, because I want to say yes to this. I want more capacity for these good things. And in order to do that, I know that I now feel good about saying no to the bad things.
Yes. And as you've talked about, you know, if we're in our trauma state, which staying in relationships with people who've been painful can keep us in our trauma state, we can't open up to other things. We can't say yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Elizabeth, I appreciate your time today to talk with us about this, because this is, you know, like I said, this is an important thing. This is something that people do struggle with. And you know, some people listening to this might now recognize they might be dealing with some trapped feelings and stuff like that, because like you know, like you talked about and let in with it, you know, we have a culture of just kind of tolerating whatever it is our family gives us, and that you really don't have to, you know, and it does sound a little bit weird, and it might make you like your little chest tighten up, you know, the thought of, you know, leaving your family. But if this happens all the time around your family, then it's probably worth, you know, sitting there and really taking a hardcore examination of whether or not, you know, some degree of separation does, you know, need to start to happen and stuff. And so I appreciate you coming in and coming in where you're sitting there at your home. I'm sitting in my studio, coming into the virtual, you know, the world here.
I think we held a container together.
We did. Yes. And it's this nice rectangle shaped box. So, but I do appreciate your time to be able to speak with me about this. And so thank you so much for this.
Oh, it was really my pleasure. I'm so honored to have been asked to be part of your community, and they're so lucky to have you. And yeah, be brave and think about that little girl, you know, or that little boy. Like, they deserve to have an amazingly free, wonderful life.
Yep. Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquiracone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quirconi, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.